Welcome to Apparently, the podcast for absolutely average parents. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Ann and I have been friends for a very long time.
We met right after college.
Yeah, and our first jobs as radio producers.
We spent our 20s as wing women for each other, and it didn't work out very well.
But then it did, and we found the right guys and stood up in each other's weddings.
And then we had babies within weeks of each other, so we went from producers to reproducers.
We make it look easy. We make it look good.
Which brings us to this podcast. We want to discuss topics that interest us and you and provide some knowledge to other average parents.
We're average, not experts. So we'll tackle these topics with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll get the experts. And I fully expect to embarrass myself along the way.
Yeah, after season one, I'm pretty sure we already have.
So welcome to Apparently.
We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody sees it, they stop and take a look.
Apparently, food allergies are about more than scanning labels for ingredients and avoiding contact.
Mm-hmm.
Psychosocial issues for families with food allergies are significant but undertreated. And many of these families report that finding mental health professionals, they can't find them. They just can't find them.
To understand their plight,
yeah.
Basically. Yeah, according to Psychology Today, food allergies actually affect 6 to 8% of kids in the United States. That's more than 5 million.
Yep.
Are actually broken down even more, 1 in 13 children.
So then if you think about it, it's like that's like two kids per classroom.
Yes. And the risk of death or significant medical costs associated with like contamination can create some really anxious households for families. And in a lot of the food allergy circles, I read somewhere about a motto called, they say, epi first, epi fast.
So just be
ready.
That's
their motto. Yeah, like, okay. Just be prepared. Kind of like the Girl Scout motto, be prepared. They're prepared with their EpiPen.
Okay. All right. So I read an article that said the anxiety of food allergies isn't just about the fear of death. You know, like that whole,
right.
You know, the epi thing. It's about the phobias associated with the allergies. Like, so for kids who had an allergic reaction and it stressed them out, right?
Yes.
Or had a bad epi injection. Or
how about all the allergy tests you have to go?
The pinpricks and the blood tests. It's almost like they have PTSD.
A little bit, yeah. I'll take that a step further. I would say, based on my kids and their friends that have food allergies, there's also a little bit of disappointment because going over to a friend's house or a sleepover or a birthday party, like you're five and you want to go have fun at the bounce houses and have a cupcake and you can't because whatever, like food dye, nuts,
eggs,
yep. Dairy,
yeah.
All that stuff. It's kind of a downer. It's psychologically, it's a little rough. So, or like try telling your kid not to take a cookie when they're over at a play date or something. That's rough.
Yeah. And I'm sure part of it too, as a parent, is relying on your kid to make that choice.
Yes. To make sure that they're aware.
Yeah.
Or putting your trust in another mom when they're over, like, please.
Yeah.
Don't have peanuts around or whatever the allergen is.
Yeah.
Like just, I don't have, you don't have. You have an allergy, but it's to gluten.
Wheat. But so that means that I'm pretty much gluten-free.
Right.
And I get hives, but I don't need an EpiPen.
Do the girls have friends that have allergies?
Oh, yeah.
Food allergies?
Yeah.
I do. I would be in charge of the EpiPen when one of her friends came over.
Really?
When they were younger, yeah.
That is really stressful to me.
It was, because I was like, please. Well, I made sure that we never had to use it, but just the responsibility of, oh my God, I might have to jam that pen.
Yeah.
Was a little bit much for me. So it was stressful for me, and it isn't even my kid.
Right. All right, to talk about food allergies, we brought in Gia Rosenblum. She's a psychologist who focuses on patients with life-threatening food allergies and the treatment of trauma.
Okay. And she's from the article that we were just talking about.
Yeah. Gia, thank you so much for being part of this.
Hi, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for bringing such attention to this topic.
Of course.
I loved your articles. I read a couple of them, and you referred to food allergies as the invisible disability. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, an invisible disability is any disability or significant life-altering issue that's not immediately obvious to public eye. So it doesn't automatically arouse the compassion, sympathy, or helping action on the part of other people. And when a disability is invisible, it requires some work on the part of the person just to be noticed as a person that might need accommodation or need help or need support. And that's, you know, completely separate from the question of whether people will then provide that support. So for people with food allergy, it's not something that you see. You're not sick. Mm-hmm. You're not, you know, unless someone is having an allergic reaction, there's absolutely no outward sign or indication that they have this issue. And so it's always on the person with the food allergy or the food allergy family to bring that to other people's attention. And that's just sort of another layer of work and effort that sure. people with this issue have to bear.
Makes sense. What are some of the most common food allergens? We've mentioned peanuts is an obvious one, or tree nuts. My daughter's friend was allergic to tree nuts. Yeah.
What are aren't there big eight or something?
Yeah, in the United States, the top eight food allergens, so the most common ones are cow's milk, egg, peanut, tree nuts, wheat, finfish, crustaceans, shellfish, and soy. Also, sesame is now sort of gaining some traction and is being talked about as perhaps going to be added, so we would have a top nine in the United States because sesame allergy is pretty prevalent. And then in other countries, the prevalence differs a little bit based on what the diet of the nation is. So in some other countries, mustard, mollusks like oysters, mm-hmm. buckwheat, celery, and lupin, which is another legume like peanuts, are also big allergens, not so much in the United States, though.
Hmm. Interesting. I wonder if it's because people eat more of those things in other cultures. I don't know. I know that's not your job.
Yeah. they are trying to figure that out. I mean, one of the things about this, you know, meteoric rise in the prevalence of food allergies is that we do not actually know why it's happening.
Right.
So research is trying desperately to figure that out so that we can work on prevention and obviously sort of stop this from happening more.
Absolutely. And so I know you're not an allergist or a medical doctor, but I wanted to get something out there. You know, the big fear that Tracy and I were just talking about is anaphylaxis, right? That's when when you need the EpiPen. Can you describe what anaphylaxis is?
Yes, sure. So anaphylaxis is a multi-organ systemic bodily response to an allergen. And it is a medical emergency. Mm-hmm. It can involve a lot of different body systems and a lot of different symptoms. But the most important thing is that if anaphylactic shock isn't treated immediately, it can be fatal. It's rare that it results in death, but it is possible. And rapid treatment with epinephrine is critically important. So when I say multiple organ systems, what I mean is that, you know, as opposed to someone like yourself, you were describing, you just get hives. So a few hives are not a life-threatening issue, obviously, but when it's hives plus wheezing right. or vomiting or diarrhea or dropping blood pressure, so a person turns pale, obviously, if they faint. Also, any swelling or constriction in the mouth, lips, throat. Something that can constrict breathing, you know, all are indications of an anaphylaxis, of this multi-system event, which needs immediate injection with epinephrine and a trip to the emergency room.
Which is why that motto circulates amongst the food family, the allergy families, is epi first, epi fast.
Yeah, and
exactly.
A year or two ago at our neighborhood Boys and Girls Club, there was a young teenager who did have anaphylaxis and she died. So, I mean,
from a contamination?
Yeah. So, it's terrifying. Like, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but it, you know, if you've got a kid who is facing this, I can't imagine how you let the kid out of your sight.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, you're raising the most critical point. So, number one is it can be life-threatening. The other critically important thing to emphasize, though, is that though any loss of life is a tragedy that is sort of unthinkable, it's also really rare.
Right. Yes.
And it's much more likely that, sadly, a child would be injured in a car accident or some other kind of situation than death by anaphylaxis. But the most important thing that families can do to protect their kids from this life-threatening situation is to always have epinephrine within arm's reach at all times, number one, to have it available. And number two, to become super comfortable with the idea of using it in case of anaphylaxis, to have you know, all your questions about using an epinephrine auto injector, whether that's an EpiPen or an AviCure. There are a bunch of different ones on the market, to make sure you feel completely comfortable using it, to practice using it. There are trainers that come in every EpiPen or AviCure or whatever kit, so you can practice with them. You can use expired auto injectors to practice on an orange. There are good videos online to watch. Boston Children's Hospital has a couple of videos, for example. So really, really becoming acquainted with and then super comfortable with the idea of giving this medicine, which is absolutely life-saving. It is a very, very, very beneficial medication.
You wrote a paper on the successful management of food allergies, and you had listed out a bunch of requirements. Can you take us through some of those and how to manage and deal and live with a food allergy?
Sure. Well, the first is what I just mentioned. So having those epinephrine auto injectors with you at all times.
Yep.
And as you guys began to talk about, so being really on top of all food related situations to be able to strictly avoid any of the foods that are known to be allergens, as well as avoiding any kind of cross contact. That's where it gets really tricky. So because very minute amounts of an allergen can trigger an allergic reaction, people with food allergies have to be careful that, like, your slice of bread didn't touch the slice of bread that had peanut butter on it, or that your cookie didn't touch somebody else's cookie, or that in the kitchen, when they were scrambling eggs for someone else's breakfast, you know, your bowl of oatmeal didn't somehow come in contact with those eggs. So there becomes a high demand for a lot of things like reading labels, as well as interviewing and sort of grilling people who are preparing food for you, whether that's at a restaurant or even, you know, at a social event or catering hall or at anybody else's house where you might eat. So as you mentioned, going on a play date isn't a simple thing for food allergy family.
No.
It's really about making sure the other families are comfortable and able to provide a safe environment for your family. And with little kids, you know, toddlers, crawlers, kids who are going to be touching surfaces, putting their hands in their mouths, it's also not just about food that's served. It's about the environment. Until kids are old enough really to be in control of that and be good hand washers and that kind of thing, it's also about, you know, cleaning practices. And is this a family that, you know, regularly sits and eats bowls of nuts on their kitchen sofa and there might be, you know, just debris around normally, even if they're a clean family? You know, because of the way toddlers and little kids behave, you have to be careful about that. You know, kids coming over, maybe they ate, we're all eating on the go, right, all the time. So if your child's friend ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the car on the way over to your house, well, you'd want that kid to wash their hands and wash their mouth before they played with your young child. So those levels of vigilance are part of daily life. There also can be allergens in non-food products like cosmetics or craft supplies. I came across a circumstance where someone was using these juggling balls that were kind of like bean bags, and unbeknownst to us, they were filled with walnut shells.
What?
And so a kid had a reaction from the dust that got kicked up from just, you know, throwing and catching these little fabric bean bags. Things can happen in unexpected places. So finding, you know, in addition, as we talked about, it's also about being able to recognize an allergic reaction when it happens. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage people that I'm working with to make sure they get, you know, good information from their allergists and their physicians, you know, what are the signs to look for, to, you know, get any questions they have about that answer, to get trained in their EpiPen or their AviCure or their auto injector so they feel super comfortable using it.
And have the extended family and friends know about it, too, so that when they're out of your care and with somebody else, they also know those signs and signals.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's the next thing, that advocating, you know, educating the people around you. My daughter's a teenager, so she last year went on her high school senior trip. And before they left, I had all of her roommates come over to our house, and we sat down and had a training session.
That's great.
So even though they've known her for years and they knew about her food allergy, I was like, you know, you guys are young adults. You really need to be able to do this yourself. So we all practiced using her auto injector, and we talked about signs and symptoms and went around the table, made sure, you know, these young teenagers were all comfortable with that.
So it sounds like the daily behaviors of people or families with food allergies are pretty overwhelming. You know, it's stressful just thinking about your kid, you know, playing with a
beanbag.
When
they're in your care, yeah.
Yeah. And so you wrote about more than that, too, though, but you said that there are factors that add to the stress and anxiety. And you started with the pervasiveness of the threat. Does that just mean that there are possible allergens everywhere?
Well, yeah, you know, food is everywhere. Food is an integral part of almost everything we do. The only, like, I'm just trying to think, like, what spaces have no food? You're not allowed to usually bring, like, a lot of food into the library. So maybe you can go to the library and find spaces where they don't allow food. But most experiences we have are experiences that have food as a part of them.
Agreed. I'm stumbling. I can't think of a single place that I haven't seen somebody have a snack or something.
And we're sitting in a radio studio where you're not supposed to have food, and there's food here.
I brought almonds in my bag.
You can do it anyway.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So that contributes to this sense of, like, okay, so as cautious as we are, there's a sense that any environment I'm in, I have to be a little bit monitoring what's going on around me.
That feels immense, right? If you realize that there's no real safe space, that could be paralyzing.
Well, and one of my goals is in working with people is to help them not feel paralyzed, to feel empowered and to feel like they have the skills they need to manage the threat. So the threat doesn't feel frightening. It feels like a challenge that they're up to. But I do acknowledge that it's a lot of work. You know, there's effort that we put out as food allergy families that other people just don't have to expend.
Right. Proactively, like you did, because it was going to be out of your control when your daughter went on her senior trip. So you proactively worked with her friends and talked about it so that you have a little bit of control. Like you know that they know what to do when she's gone on this trip.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And the other piece that sometimes people who don't have food allergies aren't aware of is that we also spend a lot of time calling manufacturers, calling restaurants, asking for detailed information about, like, food manufacture and food preparation. Because even with the labeling laws that we have that require that manufacturers list actual ingredients, those statements that you might see on foods that say, like, may contain or may have traces of, you know, that kind of stuff, that's all completely voluntary, and there's no regulation that dictates how that has to be described and the accuracy of it.
Really? That's not regulated?
Yeah. The may contain type of a statement is a voluntary description on the part of the manufacturer.
No way. Processed in a facility? Like, that's on a lot of labels I have in my house. Processed
Correct.
In a facility. That isn't a mandatory thing.
Correct. That is not mandatory. There's quite a bit of activism on the part of food allergy folks to get that to be mandated and specified what it means so that we could rely on it. But at present, it's uncertain, you know, what from one package to the next, from one manufacturer to the next. So a lot of food allergy families spend some time calling manufacturers, and there are some organizations that also do that and produce some lists for us. But it's, again, another layer of energy and effort that goes out to keep us safe, especially from things like cow's milk and eggs and gluten, which are just everywhere.
Yep, exactly.
So,
going out to eat is
super challenging.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. Going out to eat, my mother-in-law is celiac, and going out to eat is really difficult. There is usually a trip from the chef out to talk about what's in the base of the broth, or even with, like, for guacamole, going out for chips and margaritas and whatever, like, she has to have her, like, spoon her guacamole because it can't be, because she can't have corn. Yeah, she can't, like, we can't share, and I'll dip our chips in.
She can't have corn?
Yeah.
There's no gluten in corn.
I know, this is another.
That's okay.
She has multiple
sensitivities, and so, like, that's something when you're going out. It's not like, hey, let's go out to eat.
Right. When my daughter was very young, she was top 8 abstinent.
What?
All of them?
Basically, yeah, for a period of time while we were figuring out exactly what was going on for her, and she's outgrown. Then she was cow's milk, egg, peanuts and tree nuts, and then she outgrew cow's milk and egg, and we were just left with peanuts and tree nuts. And then in the past couple of years, she's actually outgrown her allergy to almonds and hazelnuts. So we're slowly adding some foods back into her diet, even in her late teens.
Wow.
Because allergy is an always evolving in sure. people's lives, and people add allergies too. A certain percentage, about 15% of allergies to foods arise in adulthood.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mine arose in adulthood. I think it was after. Yeah, it was adult. I was not allergic to wheat until I was in my 30s. Yeah.
My mother-in-law as well.
All right. So you mentioned the high social skill demands. Does that mean that our kids have to advocate for themselves?
Yeah. So in all of these things, even making that phone call to a manufacturer. So people who are socially uncomfortable or shy or, really don't like talking on the phone and then they're, have difficulty with that. Then there's going to restaurants, talking to the server, talking to the chef. Then there's advocating for yourself with your friends and family, your coach, your Boy Scout, Girl Scout leader, those kinds of things, especially in adolescence when there's a lot of self-consciousness, a lot of wanting to fit in, not wanting to call attention to yourself in a negative way. Those social skills can be really challenging. And then, of course, we have the whole issue of dating in the teen years. So I remember when my daughter had her first boyfriend and she told me, she's like, I have to stay after school today because I have to have the talk with this boy she was dating. And I was like, oh, tell me about that. She's like, well, I have to tell him about my allergies because, we couldn't ever kiss if he's not willing to be aware and not eat the things I'm allergic to.
What a huge responsibility for her.
Absolutely. So for a little, 14, 15, 16-year-old, first conversations they're having with someone they have a crush on, it's like, so I could die.
Oh my God.
So we have to address mortality here in our sophomore year of high school. It's a really big challenge, but also a really important one because food residue in someone's mouth can trigger an allergic reaction.
So do you think that nowadays with the aisles at the grocery store with gluten-free products or soy-free, nut-free, dairy-free, all those things, do you think that the food allergy community still feels like a lack of support, or are people socially hostile towards them? Like, oh, God. I know in my social circle, like, sometimes for a party, a classroom party at a school, there's no tree nuts, no peanut, no nothing. Well, then you're like, here's a bottle of water. And so sometimes people get a little fussy. Like, it's gotten to the point where you can't have anything. And so it's kind of like, ho-hum.
Yeah, it's a party pooper, right?
Kind of.
Yeah, so both are true. I will say that no question, the world is easier to navigate today than it was. My daughter was diagnosed at about 3 months old. So when I was a nursing mom, I was abstinent of the foods she was allergic to because if I ate them, she would react.
Mm-hmm.
So 18 years ago, things were much more difficult to navigate. The availability of foods, the level of awareness, the fact that there are whole restaurant chains that train their staff. I went on a college visit with my daughter the other day, and the dining hall was nut-free, and they were incredibly well-informed in this particular college. So that's all phenomenal. However, it is also the case that there's still a lot of issues with bullying. Kids with food allergies are absolutely bullied in school directly because of their allergens, with kids like deliberately trying to place an allergen in the path of a child with an allergy or deliberately trying to get them to eat it.
What?
There are documented cases of that happening. The way food allergies are depicted in movies and television is often very disparaging. It's played for a laugh. It's viewed as a weakness on the part of the person with the allergy. It's sort of looked at as a character flaw.
Oh.
So that, of course, only supports this bullying mentality. And then you're absolutely right. I have a couple of hypotheses about why food allergies are sometimes really hard for people to understand. And one of them is, I think, because certainly people in older generations were not familiar with food allergies because they didn't exist. This is an explosion in recent years. And because of what we are all taught allergies are, which is kind of like hay fever, the presumption is, I know what an allergy is. It's an inconvenience. You'll cough or maybe you'll have a runny nose or your eyes will itch. You'll be fine.
Right.
And people don't understand that this is not the same as that.
I agree with you. Generationally, that is a problem, I think.
Yeah. And they find it unbelievable. So the idea that food would harm you to that degree, that it's not a preference or like a dietary fad. You know, people are like, you know, everybody I knew ate peanut butter and jelly my whole childhood. It was never a problem. How can this be? It feels impossible to some people.
Right.
And then there's the way we relate to food. So food is a very personal, intimate thing. You know, I've had to go up to people in airplanes or in the airport, you know, who are eating peanuts and, you know, very politely and gently ask them if they would be willing not to eat that on the plane because it could endanger my child. And I personally take the approach of offering to buy them an alternative snack just to kind of take the sting out of it. But think about, like, if you just randomly went up to someone and said, don't eat that. That's like saying to a person, like, I don't like what you're wearing today. It's like a right. personal choice what we choose to eat. So I do understand that people feel intruded upon. They feel inconvenient. They feel baffled. So I do have empathy for the rest of everyone who's sort of trying to figure out how to accommodate this at the same time they want to do what they want to do.
Right. Gia, do you have to call it, like, I'm just thinking, I go to the Bears games, and they serve peanuts at Bears games. They serve peanuts at Cubs games. Do you have to call ahead and find out if you can even go?
Yeah, I mean, it depends a little bit on the sensitivity of the individual and on the situation. So in an open-air stadium, for a person who's not exquisitely sensitive, and obviously for an older child or an older adult who's not going to put their hands in their mouth, it's probably going to be safe. And that would be a question a person would have to ask their allergist about, like, my specific level of sensitivity and the specific environment. The thing about airplanes, for example, is because they're enclosed environments. And back in the day when they served peanuts to everyone on the plane, if you can imagine, like, everyone opening up one of those packets and you've got little particles that just, like, get dispersed in the air. A whole airplane full of that could definitely pose a threat.
They don't serve that anymore. Most planes serve pretzels, don't they?
Yeah.
Or nothing.
There's much more of that. I know that, I mean, personally, I've had this experience in first class, they serve heated nuts. Sometimes mixed nuts, like, you know, macadamia, pecans, stuff like that, you know, so delicious for those of us who can eat nuts. But heating and cooking food is actually one of the things that can aerosolize the protein. And it's the proteins that are actually the trigger for an allergic reaction.
Okay.
So, again, there's guidelines for safe air travel. You know, I've flown to Australia with my daughter. You know, I'm really always focused on empowering people to find out exactly what their or their child's needs are, and then to work within those safety parameters and live the richest, fullest life they can possibly live.
Sure.
So I'm all for, like, specifying what the need is, meeting the need, and then going out and living a good life.
So I'm going to tap into your psychologist background. We're a parenting podcast, and I know that in my own household, how I behave and act around my kids can translate and transcend down to them. So how can parents manage their own anxiety when they have a kiddo with a food allergy so that they don't pass it on to the kids, so the kids are, like, frenetically, like, anxious all the time about everything? Because kids are smart.
Yeah, because you mentioned something about kids avoiding things because they don't want to be in danger, and that might come from the parents, right?
It can, yeah. I mean, often I have seen both. So I have worked with kids who were really kind of phobic and had decided that the best way to stay safe was to kind of never eat anything and never do anything. And parents, you know, valiantly trying to encourage them to do more. So under those circumstances, I work closely with the kids to, you know, help them reduce their anxiety and understand what safety looks like for them. But it absolutely can go the other way. I've certainly worked with kids who were raring to go and parents who were overwhelmed with anxiety. And that's where the bottleneck was.
Okay.
So I think for managing that stress, the first thing I really emphasize is having all your questions answered. So if you have a child with a food allergy, make sure you're having a really, really good positive relationship with your allergist. And if you don't feel comfortable asking all the questions you need to ask with your allergist, it might be time to change doctors or to reach out to some other resources so you feel like you really have all the facts at hand. So, for example, I worked with a family whose child had a fish allergy, and they had questions like, is it okay to swim in the ocean? Is it okay to go to the aquarium? And they just needed those questions answered, because in their case, it was absolutely fine to do those things, but they didn't know. So they were afraid unnecessarily.
Oh, yeah.
So the first thing is making sure you have all the information you need so you understand the safety parameters for your family.
Right. Make an informed decision.
Absolutely. And then the next thing is I try to help people really listen to themselves first by acknowledging that the stress or worry, anxiety that they have is real and valid, and to open up about that either to a trusted friend, a family member, or even just picking up a pen and a paper or a tablet or your phone or whatever you like to write in, and be honest with yourself in your journal. And try to figure out what's the worst aspect or the most anxiety-provoking aspect for you, because it's not the same for everybody. So I absolutely have families for whom it's the food safety that's the scariest thing. But I have other families where, you know, they kind of got that skill set down and they have, like, figured out where they can go to eat and what they prepare at home. But the thing that's giving them the most distress is that their family members are not understanding or supportive, or the losses, as you mentioned, like not being able to just drop your kid off at a play date or have them join the choir or whatever exciting activity they want to do because there's some reason that they can't. So really kind of figuring out what's troubling you personally the most.
And then
figuring out from there, what do I need to do to get the support that is going to benefit me the most?
Do you have suggestions for how to help your family and friends get it? You know, that Tracy talked about it too. You know, that some people are just don't get it. And
because it wasn't around, my parents are kind of like that. They're like, I don't understand. Like, it was never a problem before.
Are there suggestions?
I eat dirt and I'm going to live to be 104. Like, that kind of mentality. Yeah. Can you hear that coming out of my dad?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, it can be really challenging, and you have to start by meeting people where they are. So if you're talking to an older person who's just kind of incredulous and disbelieving, meeting them there and saying, I know, it feels impossible, doesn't it? What a crazy thing that something has changed in our world where our bodies react differently to these foods. You know, nobody really knows why, but they're trying to figure it out. And trying, rather than kind of butting heads, starting by joining with them in their shock and surprise.
Right. That's a good
idea.
Then
see if, right? So that hopefully will bring their defenses down a little bit, and now you're in a dialogue instead of in a, you know, kind of adversarial communication. And then from there, trying to discern, well, what's their behavior going to be? So are they disbelieving and therefore they're not going to follow the safety rules? Because that's a very different situation than a person who's disbelieving, but they're going to do it anyway. They're like, all right, fine. If this is what you want me to do, I'll do it. I still think it's weird. You know, that's a very different situation from a family. And I have had people tell me these experiences where someone disbelieved them and deliberately tried to slip their child the food just to see, you know, to prove that it would be fine.
Oh, my gosh.
So you Yikes. Have to really assess, you know, how difficult is this situation?
Right.
If it's really a difficult situation such that your child's safety isn't guaranteed, then I would say you want to remove the child from that situation and keep working on the person to help them understand.
To bring them up to speed.
Time.
Yeah. So what strategies do you suggest? You kind of mentioned it with your daughter going off to college, but I have a friend whose daughter's a freshman far away, a plane ride away. And every time I see her around town, I'm like, how's it going? And she's in knots about the fact that her daughter has some significant food allergies. And she's just so anxious because she's so far away. And if something really happened and she was contaminated or came across something, that she's so far away and can't do anything. How can you help parents when they're letting go, not only just like not having them in their own house, which is painful enough as it is to be an empty nester, but also when there's a medical need like that?
Yeah. So there's two prongs to that, to my answer. The first has to do with helping your teenager and young adult be prepared for that independence. That's mostly about information and pretty frank discussions, not avoiding the topic. So really talking about like, so, you know, how do you imagine managing your food allergy while you're at school? What do you picture yourself doing? Who are you going to talk to in the dining hall? Where are you planning on keeping your epinephrine auto injector? You know, what about when you go to class? What about if you go out with friends? How do you feel about telling the new people? You're going to be meeting a slew of new people. That's another huge social skill demand. Are you going to tell everyone? Are you going to just tell your roommate? You know, the other thing I feel is really important with teenagers and young adults is talking very directly about intoxication, alcohol, drugs, and the degree to which that impairs judgment.
Yeah,
and meeting kids with food allergies to really understand you are probably not a safe person to just go out and get wasted.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you grab some peanuts off the bar, that's a very different thing for you than for someone else. Does that suck? Yes. That's terrible. And when I work with teenagers, I commiserate with them about, you know, that's kind of crappy. You have this burden and let's just be real about it.
Right.
The other thing I like to do a lot with teenagers is do a lot of visualization and imaginal rehearsals. So, you know, can you picture yourself at a bar? Can you picture yourself at a party? With girls, unfortunately, I'm often talking about safety from date rape and things like that. So we're already rehearsing some safety skills. Mm-hmm. So we can just fold these safety skills right into that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot about information and rehearsal. So that's for the young people. For the parents, it's about doing that and then taking care of yourself. So being overwrought and plagued with anxiety every day when your teenager is far away from you, it doesn't help them. It doesn't solve any problem and it doesn't help you.
You're spinning your wheels, so, basically. Like, it's
exactly.
It's not going to change the facts.
I saw this on a refrigerator magnet, like worrying is like a rocking chair. There's a lot of movement, but you don't get anywhere.
Yeah, that's good.
So, you know, if it's really pervasive and the person is like having trouble sleeping, having trouble concentrating at work, not being able to parent their other children, you know, things like that, then I might encourage a consultation with a mental health professional to sort of help coping with worry. If it's not at that level, then making sure you're just engaging in lots of good self-care, perhaps making a structure for yourself, like a once a day or once every other day check-in with your student. So you touch base, you get that, you know, it might just be a text message or social media, but you kind of touch base, and then recognizing that from there, your own ability to soothe yourself, your own ability to exercise, meditate, get a massage, you know, play sports, do the things that kind of dispel that adrenaline and the anxious energy that you might be holding, so that you're going to be able to bring your anxiety levels down. And getting support from other people who understand is also crucially important in all of this coping.
Good idea.
Thank you so much, Gia Rosenblum, psychologist who focuses on patients with life-threatening food allergies and the treatment of trauma. Very helpful, and we know so many people who are affected by this, and I hope that
by talking about it, I think is going to be helpful to put yourself in another parent's shoes. So when they're like maybe a little bit amped up at, you know, a bounce house place or like at a birthday party, that there's a reason for it, and just to give that parent as much support as possible because it's their baby ultimately.
Yeah.
And we all want to make sure everything's okay. So,
yeah. So thank you so much, Gia.
You're so welcome. My pleasure.
So apparently food allergies are a lot more complex, not just medically.
Yes.
But psychologically, people who have the threat are living under a lot of pressure.
Yes. It's not just about being allergic to peanuts, but living your life with an allergy to peanuts.
Yeah. And then as parents, worrying all the time.
Yeah. Navigating your relationships with others and your surroundings in different environments is hard.
And then I think as parents of kids who don't have food allergies, we need to take a real look at the parents who are dealing with this and cut them some slack.
Yeah, support them.
Yeah, because we don't need peanuts, you know?
Yeah. Like, it doesn't make or break the party if we don't have the cupcake or whatever. The kids aren't going to remember that down the road.
Right.
So I think
keep them safe.
Yes. So this episode is for all those parents out there that live every day. worrying about it.
I'm thinking of a couple of them right now.
I know, me too. I feel you with your EpiPens in your little purses. I get it.
Yep.
Well, speaking of allergies, it sure wouldn't make me allergic. I sure wouldn't be allergic to everyone rating us on iTunes.
I think every week you should try to one-up yourself.
I know, I'm trying to up my game here. But no, seriously, we're talking about, I know it sounds silly to go on iTunes and rate us or to leave a review, but it actually is really impactful, and we'd be very grateful if you would go ahead and share it on Facebook. Share our page with your friends on Facebook. Go on iTunes and leave a review about a special episode that you liked in particular. Maybe say why you liked it or how it was helpful. Those reviews matter, and people look at it and they're like, oh, maybe I'll check it out.
And then maybe they share, too. That's the whole point. And we'd also love to hear from you about topics you want covered. I just got actually a text from a former student who does not have children, but she listens to the podcast, and she had two suggestions. She's like, oh, you got to talk to these two people. And I was like, awesome. You know, bring it. Tell us what you want to hear, because that's why we're here.
Exactly. So. And this marks the end of season 4.
I know.
So we're going to be on a little hiatus and get ready for season 5, if you can believe it. So all those emails, if you can send us ideas for what you'd like to hear or investigate, because we're out, you know, we're not the experts. We're going to go out and find the experts on whatever topic it is. So give us some ideas on what you want us to go look into.
Yep. So give us a call at 331-704-0046 or email us at apparentlypodcast, that's apparentlypodcast@gmail.com. This is a WGN Plus podcast. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Thanks for listening to Apparently. We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody sees it, it's nothing big.